Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be talking with Dr. Munawwar Anis. He's a leading scholar of Muslim bioethics and Islamica in general. Then we'll turn to the beginnings of an interview with Cory Doctorow, a science fiction writer and a leading advocate of open source technology. First, our interview with Dr. Anis. Speaking today with Dr. Munawwar Anis, he's a writer and social critic, a biologist by training. He's written many interesting books, most recently Islam and Biological Futures, which addresses Islamic approach to bioethical issues. He's with us today from Indiana, is that right?
Right now I'm in Chicago.
Okay, in Chicago. And I'm looking forward to meeting him in person at the Transhumanist Bioethics Conference in June. Welcome, Dr. Anis.
Thank you very much.
Now, your work is one of the leading pieces of writing in English that I'm aware of about Islamic bioethics. Are Islamists in general becoming increasingly interested in bioethical questions?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, no. But I must qualify this blanket no. The impact of new biotechnology is certainly being felt, but to evolve a response to that, or to come up with the moral reasoning for the biotechnological products, that is not happening in the Muslim world, unfortunately. And I would say that probably one reason is that the grounds for that sort of moral decision-making is different, what we find in this part of the world as compared to in the Muslim world. Take the case of abortion, for instance. I mean, we have, apart from the morality of choice or, pro-life debate, there are certain, political dimensions to it. In the Muslim world, this issue does not arise. But abortion is permitted only under clinical conditions. That is, when there is a clinical indication that the life of the mother is in danger, so it is better to save one life than to lose two. It is only in that case that abortion is permitted. Otherwise, voluntary abortion as such is prohibited.
You heard that there's a case right now in Turkey where a German woman, pregnant woman, is brain dead, and the Turkish government or hospital officials are deciding to keep her alive until she delivers, whereas in Germany she would have been aborted and terminated.
That's right. Yeah. I can bring a parallel from the, Islamic history in the sense that if a woman is convicted of some crime and she has to undergo punishment, but if she's pregnant, that punishment is postponed till she delivers, and she recovers from the delivery and, she is in physically in proper shape to receive the punishment.
So is this doctrine pretty similar to the Christian or Catholic doctrine of fetal personhood, that you're a person from the moment of conception?
There is a slight difference there in the sense that there is a tradition of the prophet, and there is quite a bit of literature on this subject, which says that ensoulment, generally it is believed that ensoulment takes place around 120 days. There are at least five different schools of thought, but generally this 120 days limit is accepted. So before that, I wouldn't say that before 120 days, there is no such thing as personhood. So we can derive from those, medieval scholars' opinions that the person begins to shape up after 120 days, which approximates to about the end of first trimester.
In Israel, the chief rabbinate is currently split about the question of cloning. On the one hand, there are those who, as in most Christian doctrines, would argue that cloning is a form of a playing God. And on the other hand, there are rabbis who are so pro-natal, who follow a kind of Orthodox Judaic injunction that anything that increases fertility for married couples is good, that they argue that cloning would be acceptable as a fertility technique.
Mm-hmm.
You've written about cloning as well. Is there a distinctively Islamic or variety of Islamic approaches?
I would argue on the cloning that... let me just qualify my statement before that. That, you know, on these issues, there's very little thought from the Islamic world. And whatever edicts we hear from the religious scholars, those edicts tell us that these people really do not understand the biology of it. So that is, the substantive knowledge is missing from there. You know, when you make a decision, you have to know on what basis you are making that decision. I bring an example from one of the edicts of the Libyan scholars. They prohibited artificial insemination. Now, as you know, artificial insemination of two kinds. I mean, you know, artificial insemination by husband and by donor. I can understand the prohibition for the husband. I'm sorry, for the donor, but I do not understand why they would prohibit artificial insemination by husband. So again, this applies. You know, whatever variations are there on the theme of biotechnological issues, we find the same problem, that not much thought has been given, and the moral reasoning has been lacking. On the specific issue of cloning, I would argue that according to the Islamic philosophy, the body, the human body, is a trust from God. And that is why precisely suicide is totally prohibited in Islam. So by replicating that trust, something that you have been entrusted with, and utilizing it in some other way, probably will not be permissible. But in line with the rabbinate, the Islamic argument would be that yes, it would be permissible if it brings treatment for certain disorders, or if there are clinical indications.
So, if as a fertility technique for parents who couldn't have children with normal reproduction?
Yes.
I'm speaking with Dr. Munawar Anis. Dr. Anis is a social critic, writer, and bioethicist, a biologist by training, and currently I'm speaking to him from Chicago. Dr. Anis, a couple of years ago, you got in trouble in Malaysia. Could you recapitulate, as I'm sure you've done many times, what the nature of your political difficulty was?
It's just another example of the political corruption and the political repression. For that, unfortunately, the Muslim world has become famous in recent years. I was the advisor to the Deputy Prime Minister, and he fell out of favor with the Prime Minister, who is still there, Mahathir, and then I was framed into false allegations were brought out against me. Mahathir ordered my kidnapped. I was chained to my hospital bed for something like 126 days. It was a nightmare going through all those brutalities and tortures and physical tortures, psychological blackmailing and whatnot. But I was overwhelmed by the response from people outside, in the outside world, particularly the Amnesty International, Pan International, Human Rights Watch, the Committee Against Torture, a lot of other organizations, and particularly the individuals, who rallied my friends. They set up a website, that became very popular at that time. For almost 2 years, I literally lost my ability for articulate speech. I earned my bread by writing, and I could not write one single coherent sentence for the next 2 years. I had to take a lot of medication, undergo psychiatric treatment, and here we are.
You were nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize in February 2002.
Yes, some of the friends did that, and Again, that came as a big surprise to me.
That's a wonderful accolade. The particular charges that were trumped up against you, one of the charges was a charge of sodomy, which carries a death sentence in Malaysia.
Yes. The political motive was because the Islamic culture looks at homosexuality, both male and female, with a very from a very bad perspective. I mean, it is prohibited, both male and female. So if you accuse somebody of being homosexual, it's the finest tool that you have got for character assassination. And he tried to do that. He, in fact, charged adopted brother of the Deputy Prime Minister and myself. And the so-called, the court proceedings were carried out according to that, because the charge is for sodomy. And then the court said that, well, we would be lenient, and we will punish these culprits for 6 months in prison.
And so you're all better now.
Well, once in a while. I mean, it's been now almost 3 years. 3 years have gone by. So I'm better. But once in a while, yes, I do, relapse into nightmares and all sorts of things happen. But
you're teaching in Indiana?
I was, but no longer. I'm at the moment a special consultant with John Templeton Foundation.
Which is working at the Religion and Science Interface.
That's right.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
And you're an American citizen.
I'm proud to be one.
Uh-huh. That didn't help at all.
Not really. Well, I would say that our ambassador was very, very cooperative. And, he did everything he could do. But then, in front of these kind of dictators and criminals, you do have limits. You can't do certain things.
Well, what is your view about the best way forward for promoting liberal and democratic ideas in the Islamic world? I mean, from right now we're about to go to war to allegedly promote some version of democracy in Iraq. Many people fear that it may have quite the opposite effect throughout the Arab and Islamic world. What are your views on the best way to promote these views?
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what America stands for. I must say that we as a nation have failed in doing a good PR. It reminds me of the Department of State initiative about a $15 million PR project that they started a few months ago, and then they produced a couple of videos. Now, these are isolated attempts. I mean, you have to have some sort of consistency and some sort of agenda, and then go for it. Look at the America as a benefactor. America transfers enormous amount of technology. It trains hundreds of thousands of students from the Muslim world. It engages in trade in billions and trillions of dollars with the Muslim world. But look at the problem with the image. I personally believe that the amount that we're going to spend in war, even one-tenth of that amount, if that amount is devoted for improving the American image across the Muslim world, I think we'll be in a lot better shape.
Mm. So do you think that this intervention in Iraq would be counterproductive, or is it the way it's shaping up going to be productive?
It would be counterproductive in the sense that, given the existing mood, given the existing climate in the Muslim world, and they feel that America is out there to destroy Islam, and I think that is the biggest misunderstanding, and that needs to be somehow or the other clarified in the minds of the people that no, look, we are after terrorists who have committed these horrendous crimes against our nation. We are after justice. We are not against Muslim people as such. We don't want to destroy the Muslim world. That is not in our interest. But this message is apparently not going out.
I'm speaking with Dr. Munawar Anis. He's a writer, social critic, biologist, bioethicist. He has many accolades to his name. Let's go back to bioethics for a second. When we started talking about the Muslim or Islamist approach to bioethics, which you say is very rudimentary at this point, another thing that we're going to be addressing together in June is the approach to the possibilities of enhancing human life and extending human lifespan, potentially making humans more intelligent, more long-lived, and so forth. A lot of Christian groups have a problem with this. They see it, as we said, as playing God. Do you think that this is also reflected in Islamic thinking and a kind of innate suspicion of any attempt to improve upon the divine creation?
There are actually two dimensions to it. One is that it is a religious obligation upon Muslims to improve life, to improve the quality of life. And at the same time, they are not supposed to, there is no such thing as playing God in that context. Whatever you do, whether it is enhancement of life, whether it is enhancement of, I mean, like implanting a chip in the brain to supposedly, you know, go for, higher cognitive abilities and so on and so forth. So whatever you do, whatever is the technological extension to the physiological functions or humanly functions, Islam will look at it positively. It will not frown upon it, saying that no, you are playing God. But if it is the premise that under which you operate is that you are not the creator. The creator is the Lord. Creator is God. You are not the creator. So with this fine distinction, I don't see that these technological interventions would cause any problem. But it's a question of interpretation by the religious scholars. How much do they understand these technological interventions? As I mentioned in case of bioethics, they understand very little.
Is there a tradition of Islamic humanism parallel to the Christian humanism, a tradition which says, you know, yes, there is a God, but it's human beings' obligation. As you said, there's a religious injunction to improve life.
Yes.
But within the traditions of religious humanism, there's this notion that we should be more self-reliant and less expectant of divine intervention, miracles and so forth, and prayer, and that that reason and science can be compatible with religion.
Certainly. If you, I can quote, directly from the Quran, which says that God does not change the fate of a nation unless they change themselves. So struggle to change yourself is very much called upon. It is obligatory.
Hmm.
You know, it's a part of the religious belief. That your actions, you do your good, you do your bit, you do your best, and then leave the results to God.
Hmm.
That you are not supposed to sit idle and expect something from the heavens to fall upon you. No, you have to struggle, you have to improve. You know, in that sense, it is. I mean, I dare say that it's very much evolutionary that you keep on developing yourself, to keep on evolving yourself, but with the understanding that you're doing it all as a sign from God, that who has given you a wisdom and intelligence to do this, but the final result, again, lies with Him.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Dr. Anis. A lot of your writings are on the web, thankfully, a couple of your writings are on the web. There are some things that people can read. If they do a search on MUNAWARANEES, and your work at the Templeton Foundation, can we expect that you'll be writing things from there as well?
Yes, my work at the Templeton involves the development of a sort of mega project on the Muslim world. in the context of religion and science. And we are trying to develop different components under this program, which also calls for a new quarterly journal. We have tentatively termed it Convivencia, Perspectives in Islam and Science, with the multi-faith, multidisciplinary board of editors. And then we are also planning to announce a prize for essay writing, specially commissioned books, and a very heavy presence on the web.
That's great. That'll be a good resource.
Right.
People have exploded in interest in Western countries, at any rate, in Islam since 9/11. So.
Yes, right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking with Dr. Munawar Anis. He's a biologist, social critic, writer, thorn in the side of the Malaysian government at times, and he'll be at the Transhumanism and Bioethics Conference at Yale in June. Thanks for being with us.
I thank you.
Now let's turn to a little bit of an interview with Cory Doctorow, the rest of which I'll broadcast next week on Change Surfer Radio, and you can listen to it online at changesurfer.com. Cory Doctorow is an award-winning science fiction author. He's the author most recently of Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, a novel from Tor, which projects the transhuman Disney world as a socialist, participatory, democratic paradise. And he's also an advocate of open source technology. He is an evangelist for the Electronic Frontier Foundation and has a blog at boingboing.net. His website can be found at craphound.net. This is just a snippet, and the rest you'll hear next week. And I also want to go back for a second to the Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, which takes place in Disney World. And you said in some interviews that you were inspired and have always been inspired by things Disney, and especially by Walt Disney's revolutionary Epcot vision. I just want to—I really related to that because when I became a sociology undergraduate back in the early '80s, one of my fantasies after I read about Epcot was to be the social engineer at Epcot. And so I completely understand the fixation that you had on this concept of a high-tech planned community. But it's interesting for us, for leftists like us, to latch on to the really visionary and revolutionary quality of an entrepreneur like Walt Disney, who had a completely revolutionary vision, and I think Marx would have related to his revolutionariness.
Sure. I mean, actually, you know, he and Marx were two of a feather in the sense that they both believed strongly in centralized planning. You know, the Disney organization, for all that it had a lot of opportunity for people who were on the front lines to suggest changes up to management, was as rigid a command and control structure as you could ask for. And, you know, he really believed that the Central Committee should sit down and make a 5-year plan, and then with input from the various committees below them, and then you should stick to the plan, by God. And, you know, I think the idea of something like the Internet, not what it can do, but how it's organized, this kind of bottom-up, non-deterministic networking technology that we use, would have really scared the shit out of both Walt and old Carl. You know, I love the hubris of Epcot. I think that there is something just amazing in this, kind of dippy futuristic vision of building a domed city and then writing a contract that supersedes the Constitution and getting everyone who lives there to sign into the contract. It's kind of like, you know, the condo from hell. You know, in addition to your condo agreement barring you from, you know, painting your door a certain color, it'll also specify how long your hair can be. And I think it's an amazing vision. It's not necessarily one that I want to see come to pass, but it certainly is a testament to the guy's grandiosity and to his willingness to think very big indeed.
Lee Kuan Yew probably would have appreciated it as well, the dictator of Singapore. We're going to transcribe this interview for Transhumanity Magazine, which is the e-zine of the World Transhumanist Association. I see that you've written in various places that you're aware of the transhumanist movement. Just give us some advice. What do you think for the transhumanist cause, the promotion of the concept that we should be able to change our bodies, what are the most important things that we should be keeping in mind? You're a kind of skilled memologist about these things.
Boy, that's a good question. You know, I've never considered it from that angle, but I would say that the way that technologists tell their story best is when they can point to real motherhood successes. You know, when you think of say ham radio operators, amateur radio operators sit on all this beachfront spectrum property that is worth a small fortune at auction. And, you know, every once in a while the government says, well, you know, what good do these amateur radio operators do? Maybe we should take that spectrum and sell it to a 3G carrier or a broadcaster. And when that happens, the amateur radio operators always come out on top. And the way that they do it is that they spend a lot of time working on disaster relief. They spend a lot of time working on emergency communications relays and assisting with emergency services. And every time they do it, they get a Congress critter to stand up in either the House or the Senate and read a commendation for the good amateur radio operators of East Nowhere, Texas, into the record. And whenever the FCC says, maybe we should do something about this spectrum we've allocated to the amateurs, they whip out the big book of congressional commendations and they say, you know, we've got a lot of powerful friends. So I think maybe the answer lies somewhere in finding some good motherhood issues, some places, you know, fix Superman's spine, right? I think once you fix Superman's spine or found a transgenic grain that isn't encumbered by patents and part of some dumbass Monsanto business model and used it to feed millions of Africans or what have you, I think that people will have a lot harder time characterizing what you're doing as a kind of Frankenstein effort. It's, you know, no one points at the hams and says, look at those info-hippie anarchists who are doing, you know, crazed info-hippie anarchic things with our public airways. They go, look at those brave and dedicated radio otaku who spend all their time sitting in the basement relaying messages to firemen. And I think that is the strategy that would make transhumanism into a mainstream cause, into a cause that would be unassailable.
Check back next week for the rest of this interview with Cory Doctorow, or check it out online at changesurfer.com.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.